That was a good start. This podcast of Word of Mouth is supported in part by Doucette Survey.
Nice.
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
There's more information at doucetsurvey.com. We could do it like robots.
Word of Mouth Daily Podcast, sponsored by Doucette Survey.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. In some places, it can be used to treat pain or other medical conditions. In others, you can walk into a store and buy it over the counter for whatever reason you decide. And yet, thousands of Americans are currently incarcerated for using or distributing it. I'm talking, of course, about marijuana. Now, with so many conflicting narratives around the drug, it's hard for adults to know exactly what to think, never mind what to tell their kids. KJ Delantonia writes the Motherload blog for the New York Times. She sat down with Virginia to talk about how changing laws and perceptions around marijuana are challenging today's parents.
So for a long time, the conversation around marijuana was a pretty short one. Just say no. Is this abbreviated approach useful for parents today?
You know, I don't think that anything quite so simple is going to work anymore. Teenagers know that marijuana is legal in some places, but many people argue that it's safer than alcohol. They can get to it more easily, and I think we're just going to have, at the very least, a longer version of that conversation.
So what are some of the different ways that parents are handling this issue now?
Well, I mean, parents are handling it in ways across the board. A colleague of mine wrote a neat recent article about, you know, five families who ranged from, lighting the joints and baking the nachos, literally, to, you know, to taking the doors off of a child's room who had been found with some marijuana and taking away all his drawers and sort of really, you know, really, really coming down hard. So there are, you know, there's a range, and there's going to be a range depending on where you are and what children can get to easily. It's going to be a huge variety of approaches for a while.
Well, I think a lot of us, you know, grew up with the parent who was, we heard, you know, smoked pot with their kids, and of course the others who were super, super strict. So do you have a sense whether this spectrum of how parents are dealing with pot is different than it was a decade or two ago, or is it just more open now that the public perception and visibility of marijuana has changed?
You know, I suppose that the on the extreme ends, it's probably not that different. But what's really changing is the approach of those of us in the middle. Maybe we're not sure ourselves how we feel about legalization. Maybe we used marijuana ourselves as teenagers or as young adults. Maybe we still do. And maybe we live somewhere where we can do that legally, and maybe we don't.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many variables right now. It's actually kind of fascinating. I mean, there's how you're going to talk to your own kids about it. Then there's what you do if your neighbors are regular and legal marijuana users. Is that something you need to have a conversation with your kid about? Is that something you need to have a conversation with them about, depending on how old your kid is? There is... It's really a whole new and kind of fascinating world.
Yeah, that's what's so fascinating to me, that it's going to be more acceptable as more states legalize marijuana, and that's kind of where trends are going. That, you know, at the family barbecue, rather than the neighbor or Uncle George, you know, pulling out a beer, he might light up or vape or something
all
like
true.
That.
All true, in Boulder at least, if not necessarily in Cleveland.
Right, exactly. But, you know, how should parents respond to pot used by other parents if they are using it legally? It's kind of awkward.
It really is. And we're at this moment where right now, I think even in Boulder, jaws might still drop just a little bit at most barbecues. 10 years from now, who knows? New York City just... declared that they aren't going to make arrests for people carrying around an ounce. That's sort of a de facto legalization of, again, possession but not sale. So it's changing in some places and not in others. It's really kind of wild. But one thing that's really important to remember and to emphasize is this is not legal for teenagers anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what is the research telling us about pot use and effects on kids?
Well, the research is in flux as well. Some researchers are going to argue that regular and consistent pot use, at least, has really been shown to affect a growing brain. It affects memory. It affects ability to make good, you know, good decision making. I think that's your frontal cortex. So there's some evidence about that with respect to regular use. There's not a lot of evidence about, you know, the effects of casual use. There's also evidence that regular marijuana use is associated with lower grades and less life satisfaction and less happiness. But, you know, again, that's the usual correlation causation problem. And really, there's not a hard and fast line to hold on that.
But parents may still want to take a zero tolerance approach for kids.
Well, it is still illegal. And, you know, listen to some of the consequences of a marijuana conviction. That's going to rule you out. You're not going to be able to travel to many countries. Casual marijuana use, if you admit to it, still is going to rule you out for jobs with anything from the FBI to the fire department to the police department to, you know, maybe your White House internship. What teenagers decide now about pot can affect their lives later. There are colleges, universities, and employers who will take social media evidence of pot use pretty seriously. It's really something to consider about whether you end up with a conviction or not.
Well, it's adding to the complication, of course, is that in places where the law has changed to allow recreational or medicinal marijuana, weed doesn't look like it used to, you know, edibles and vapors. Is that going to change the way that parents need to think about marijuana?
I think it should, and I think it should change it in two ways. First of all, when your kids are young, it seems to me that it would be a lot easier for a relatively young child to accept a piece of marijuana chocolate from a friend or from anyone than it would be to hand them over, you know, a lit joint. That's a little different. And even with teenagers, it's more of a stretch to take something and smoke it or vape it or use a pen than it is to eat it. Eating is a familiar and easy activity, and candy is appealing, and those marijuana chocolate bars, heck, they look good.
Do you think, KJ, there are any advantages to having a more permissive policy on pot, even if only for kids who are 18 or older?
You know, I have such mixed feelings about this. I am actually a former New York City prosecutor, and I would agree that much of the drug prosecution that we did, for especially around marijuana, was ridiculous and time-consuming and expensive for society. On the other hand, now, as a parent, I see that legalizing marijuana is going to make it easier to get. I have read and understand the arguments about it being safe, but I'm not sure whether I'm fully on board with that. It's a complicated topic.
I imagine if your kids were teenagers and one of them came home with evidence of pot, the conversation would be altogether out of the theoretical realm.
It would be, and you know what? It will be. I have four kids.
Right.
Statistically, you know, one of them is going to, if not more than one, is going to give this a shot. And it is a little hard to say theoretically what you're going to say. You do need to be ready. And one of my favorite things that I have heard is the importance of having a conversation, not a lecture. You know, talk with your kids about beforehand, if you can, why they might try it, why they might be tempted to try it, even if they think now that they wouldn't, why people do try white marijuana and why they use it. And then after, you know, if you have found that your child is using or has given it a try, talk about why they made that choice before you start yelling about what's going to happen as a result.
So, best way to approach those conversations, KJ, any advice?
I think that the question is where to start. And the answer that I have heard is every opportunity that you can. If you're a parent and you're listening to this in your car right now, as happens to me a lot, now's a great time to bring this up, no matter how old your kids are. If they're young, do they know what marijuana is? Have they seen it? If they're in the middle grades or early teen years, have they seen it? Have they seen any friends using it? Have any of their friends talked about using it? Have they seen it used in movies or in cartoons? What are they seeing? What do they know? And if they're teenagers, what are they seeing? You know, their friends, and that can be, quote, friends or you know, or not. What are they seeing going on? Try to get them to have a conversation with you. And, boy, when they're in the back seat and you're in the front or they're in the passenger seat and you're next to them, that is the best time.
Well, what about for parents who use, which is becoming more and more common?
Parents who are regular users for medical reasons or for recreational users should be honest mm-hmm. with their kids about, you know, what they're doing in the same way that you would be about alcohol, I think. And I think it's actually probably a very similar conversation. It's just that we're not ready as a society to have it that way.
KJ Dell'Antonia, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
KJ Dell'Antonia blogs about family for The New York Times. You can find links to her many articles and contributions on parenting in the age of legalized marijuana at wordofmouthradio.org.
Look, Dad, it's not...
Where did you get it?
Dad,
answer me. Who taught you how to do this stuff?
You, all right? I learned it by watching you.
This week, the Oxford Dictionary named vape the 2014 word of the year, citing the fact that usage of the term has doubled in just the last 12 months. But people aren't just saying vape, they're doing it more too. According to Wells Fargo, vaping has become a major part of the estimated $2.5 billion e-cigarette industry, which is projected to reach $10 billion in the next 3 years. So what's driving the market? Addiction to nicotine? Marketing? A gateway for those looking to quit smoking? Turns out, the answer is not so simple. Leah Satilli wrote about the surprisingly complex vaping scene in an article for The Atlantic, The Right to Vape. So I suppose we should get right into the lingo, because there is lingo, and some of this I didn't know anything about until I read your article. Now, the FDA refers to them as e-cigarettes. Does the vaping community use that same term?
You know, they do. I mean, I've heard people say e-cigs, or but people who smoke e-cigarettes generally call themselves vapers, and that's because what they're doing is they're using these battery powered devices that actually turn this e-juice, which has tobacco in it, into aerosol, and so that's turns into vapor essentially. So they call themselves vapers.
Now, when we hear about e-cigarettes, we think of the ones that they sell at gas stations and are designed, you know, to look like cigarettes. But they really run the gamut. How much do these devices differ in terms of size, specs, cost, that sort of thing?
Oh, my God. I mean, it's anything you can think of. I mean, there it goes from, like you said, the sort of they're called cigalikes, where they look like cigarettes. And those are generally manufactured by big tobacco companies, but they range all the way to, you know, reusable giant ones. They have ones that look like guitar pedals, ones that look like, I mean, cigars. They really do range in every sort of shape, size, cost. So as far as the ones that are cigalikes, those generally are cheaper and more disposable. But when people get really into vaping, as a lot of the people I wrote about are, they will spend up to $300 or $500 on some of the more premier devices, I guess.
And it sounds like, you know, especially once we get towards something that's custom, that looks like you mentioned, a guitar pedal, we're seeing people that are really trying to distance themselves from smoking and big tobacco and the, you know, the sort of cigarette image in general.
Absolutely. I mean, some of the people I chatted with for my story, I mean, they're actually offended by the fact that big tobacco would even try and get in on this, because what they see is that the vaping has helped them quit smoking, and that they feel like smoking was something that they were really marginalized because of, they were really ashamed of. And so now they've broken away from these addictions and they're vaping, but now with big tobacco getting in on it, they're kind of like, wait, no, you're not invited to this party. This is just for us.
Well, to get a better sense of how different the vaping community can sort of make it sound compared to cigarettes and tobacco, here's a clip of Rodney Jerabak. I think that's how you pronounce his name. He's the founder of Five Ponds. Now, that's a company that manufactures high-end vapor liquid.
I think what differentiates Five Ponds as well is the fact that we only had five original flavors to start. We've got, you know, and we're only launching fives. We've got five more coming down the road, which slated right now as the mixology edition, where every one of those flavors will mimic a signature cocktail, let's just say. Everything will have a subtle alcohol note.
Leah, he sounds like he's talking about wine. Is there like an artisanal aspect to this community?
You know, with Five Ponds, there definitely is, which was a big reason why I wanted to talk with them, because you see e-juice everywhere. I mean, in gas stations, you'll find, you know, candy apple or sour apple flavored e-juice.
And I guess we should clarify real quickly that e-juice is, well, what is e-juice?
Well, e-juice is it's a liquid that you put into your refillable cigarette. So it's a mix of propylene glycol and vegetable glycerin, and then there's also nicotine in it. And people can kind of mess with the percentage of nicotine that they're actually vaping. So some people do vape a 0% nicotine e-juice, which is interesting because that means that they're really just vaping nothing in a way. So to answer your question, yes, there with Five Ponds, there's definitely this kind of high-end cigar smoker type of e-juice that they're trying to make. And I know that Five Ponds has things like crisp mint with chocolate undertones and a vanilla finish, those sorts of that kind of language that they use to describe their flavors. But really, everyone that I chatted with for my story talks about that this is sort of this great equalizer with vaping, that anybody can do it. And there's, you know, women in their 70s that do it. And there's really kids in their 20s that have never smoked cigarettes, but have actually pick up vaping for the first time.
Well, and that's, of course, an issue that I think a lot of people, especially on the medical side of this, would be concerned about, not wanting new people to pick up vaping who aren't even smoking cigarettes in the first place. But I want to move towards another subculture that you talked about. Now, this is something called cloud chasing. I guess maybe could you tell us what it is just briefly before I play you this clip?
Absolutely. I mean, and I'll be honest, cloud chasing was the reason that I did this story and then was surprised by what I uncovered. So on Instagram, you'll see lots of people posting these pictures of them blowing these absolutely ridiculously large clouds of vapor. And that's what cloud chasing is. It's sort of this competitive activity to blow the biggest clouds of vapor that you can. I was confused by it because I didn't really know what the point was. But then when I had someone describe it to me as sort of like, it's almost like beer bonging or shotgunning a beer, then it kind of made a little bit more sense. It's sort of this silly thing, I guess.
Okay, so we found a clip online. It's like cloud chasing 101. It's a guy basically explaining how to do it and how to modify your vaping equipment to do it as best as possible.
You see, the average vapers don't realize how much technique goes into cloud chasing, to the point where it can be considered an art form. I mean, it's hard.
So it sounds to me a little bit like he's really trying to legitimize this as, I guess, maybe a sport. But are some of these kinds of pro vaping, pro cloud chasing trends and even events, because there are competitive events where people cloud chase, is this hurting, I guess, the cause for people who just want to replace cigarettes with vapor, which may or may not be healthier, but probably is?
You know, that's the real question, I think, because on one hand, there are people who say that cloud chasing is sort of this really great community of people that are really accepting and they want to just kind of get together and blow these clouds and whatever. But for some of the folks I chatted with for my story, they definitely said, you know, this looks bad. We don't know if this stuff it has not been proven yet to be healthier than smoking. So for young folks to be picking it up and, you know, really taking in this massive amount of the substance that isn't approved by the FDA, it might actually end up putting further regulation on it in advance of the FDA figuring out if it's good or bad. I think it could be pretty bad for the industry.
So you mentioned that, you know, big tobacco is definitely trying to wade in on this market. But right now it seems like there's so many different manufacturers, there's so many different retailers of the e-juice, of the equipment that people use to vape. What's going to happen to these quote unquote little guys if big tobacco really gets in on the e-cigarette game in a big way?
You know, that's a really good question. I think things could really, really change because I think that it could end up becoming a very expensive industry to be a part of. From everything, like e-juice companies may need to make it so all of their products are in glass bottles, or every item that they have, they pay a certain amount for it to be licensed and everything. So I think if Big Tobacco really does get in on it, I think we're going to see the industry completely change.
Leah Sottile, thank you so much for explaining this really interesting, sort of weird subculture for us.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Leah Sottile wrote about the vaping scene in an article for The Atlantic, The Right to Vape. You'll find a link to her article and a video of cloud chasing on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. You may have heard that changes to NPR's Morning Edition clock went into effect this week. But why should you care? When we come back, an in-depth look into how public radio is made and why the design of a program clock really does matter.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, filling in for Virginia Prescott. Dedicated public radio listeners may have noticed this week that some long-planned changes to NPR's program clocks went into effect, most noticeably to Morning Edition. But for most, these changes were probably imperceptible. And that's sort of the idea with radio. We want you to be focused on the content, not the format. Our next story about why clocks matter comes from 99% Invisible and producers Roman Mars and Julie Barton.
Ready, open on Roman. Open, go.
When I'm not making radio, I listen to a lot of radio. More than most people can imagine.
Set a down clock for 4:30, please.
My earbuds are constantly lodged in my ears so that I can press play and listen to radio at any moment that doesn't require me to talk or listen to an actual human being in the real world.
All right, well, now is the moment in our show where we endorse
Management Oversight by Tori Malatia.
Audio newspaper for a visual world.
Sure! AnswerMeThisPodcast.com.
The show's produced by Speaking Into Microphones.
Hello, it's Jason Isaacs.
Stand by to open Julia.
Whether I'm walking on secret stairs or doing the dishes.
Open.
Or driving the car.
You're there, but you're somewhere else, too.
We producers aspire to create driveway moments, TM. Stories so good that listeners can't leave their car until they're over.
I think part of what makes a driveway moment is the end of that moment, when you realize what time it is. You could have been staring at a clock all along, but for a while, for once, it had no power over you.
That time distortion field is one of public radio's secret awesome powers, which is why it is such a shock when those of us go from being radio listeners to radio producers like me and my friend Julia Barton here. The audience is hearing this.
It's hard to believe he's not nervous.
But this is what radio sounds like on the inside.
I'm 32 seconds short of what I'm supposed to have.
It's only Monday.
So what I'll do is I'll just play 15 seconds of this song. And then while we play this 15 seconds, you will...
I visited NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. and sat in on the live roll of All Things Considered, their flagship afternoon news magazine show. There are clocks all over the studios. Big red digital clocks, huge round analog clocks, special software and calculators.
Time calculators, where 60 plus 60 equals 200.
Hi.
Matt, Brandon wanted me only to play 15 seconds, but you wrapped up 45 seconds earlier, so now I have to play a long time. Is it okay?
Yeah, I mean, we don't have a choice, really. Do we have enough to dead roll it?
I don't think so.
Monica Estativia directs All Things Considered 4 days a week. To me, it's the scariest job in the world.
That fear is built into the design of a program like All Things Considered. It's the show clock. The show has a set clock. It's a template from which it almost never varies. Every show that broadcasts or aspires to broadcast in the public radio system has a clock. Basically, it looks like a pie. It's round and it's sliced in lots of weird ways. Some of the slices are very thin. There's 59 seconds for the program opening. We call that the billboard. 14 seconds for the funding credits. A fatter slice is 5 minutes for the newscast. The biggest slices are lettered A, B, C, and D, and they are the segments. That's where the stories and interviews live, and they have to fit together.
1 minute to close.
I remember I was very scared of the clock. It took me years to figure it out completely.
The clock is your master for the 2 hours the show rolls out. Everything has to be ready. Segments can't run long by even a second, because most of the local stations are automated to cut off the national program where the clock says they can. These times are called posts. You have to hit the post. Nothing can go wrong.
But of course, things go wrong every day. Someone reads too long, an interview runs too short. You might hear the dreaded dead air. Or someone rushing to hit the post.
Then listeners can hear the clock. He who can't be named in public radio.
And then the spell is broken.
When you look at this document, you see something very regimented, and we've talked about how it is very regimented in terms of things happening at a particular second. But the goal is for people not to really know it's there.
That's Greg Dixon, who also directs All Things Considered. But like most show directors, he never actually looks at the diagram of the program clock.
This visual representation was hard for me to reference quickly. I had a piece of paper where I lined out every single time when things started and how long they were going to be. It was my cheat sheet, and I brought it into the studio every day.
And according to Greg Dixon, he brought it in much longer than he actually needed it.
Until it was in tatters. But those crib sheets, and you will find them everywhere in broadcast, are a bridge to the place where the clock actually lives.
You can wake us up in the middle of the night, and we can be like 59, 5, 28, 12, 28, 128, like 7:48. We know we can go down the entire hour without ever stopping, because we know it. We know it by heart, and of course we had dreams about it.
At NPR, they're called director's dreams.
You lose control. You cannot regain back control, and you have lost sense of how much time is left in the segment, how much time is left for that piece, and usually it's like the worst panic attack. And you wake up and you're sweating, and you can't believe you just had another director's dream.
I've had those where I'm on the board announcing Morning Edition on KALW, and the sliders don't do anything. And the buttons just don't look right. And so rather than try anything, I'm just paralyzed with fear.
Oh, yeah. In my dream, I'm doing a newscast with no copy. And I just have to talk and talk and talk and talk and talk like an idiot until the clock goes down. And I haven't even seen a down clock in ages.
Now, with podcasts, there is no time scarcity, no interlocking gears of local and national broadcasts. And that changes everything. But we also make a version of this show that fits inside the NPR clock, the C segment of Morning Edition, to be exact. 4 minutes and 30 seconds exactly.
Over by 1:43.
So I'm going to have to figure out a way to take all of these ideas, or at least some fraction of these ideas, and cram them into a show that's less than 5 minutes. And sometimes that really, really sucks. But you'd be surprised how often I actually really like the brief radio version of this program. The first time I really internalized the difference between doing radio and doing podcasts was when people would tell me that they wanted my stories to be longer. In the entire decade of radio I produced prior to this podcast, no editor has ever asked me to go longer.
Yeah, and I was your editor, Roman, and I can vouch for that.
You were so mean to me.
I was so mean, 4:30 sucker.
But podcasts have no constraints. You can be any length. The only constraint is the content. And people always tell me they wish this podcast was longer, but I think the show would suffer if it went on too long. And so maybe there's a need for a clock, even if the clock isn't strictly required. Constraint, or maybe just restraint in this case, makes for better art.
When I started thinking about the broadcast clock as a piece of design, I wondered how it all got started in public radio. NPR came together in the late 60s and the early 70s when network news was king. And those broadcast shows, of course, had a clock.
But public radio news wanted to be something different because of this guy.
I'm Bill Siemering, and I was the first director of programming for NPR.
Bill Siemering!
Bill Siemering. He came up with the whole idea of All Things Considered, which, of course, everyone in the business now refers to as ATC.
In the original mission statement, ATC was called a daily identifiable product.
But you decided that wouldn't be a good name for the show going forward.
Right.
Bill Siemering was among the earliest designers of the public radio sound. That sound included lots of audio and voices from the world outside the studio, and it called for a documentary-style approach, even to same-day news. For that, Bill designed a very open clock.
We didn't have a lot of breaks throughout it. And it was, this frustrated some people because they thought they wanted a very fixed clock. There was a clock, but it was not that tight. It was tight where we had joins with the stations, but otherwise it was not. And I think that's one of the things that made it interesting to listen to, because it wasn't predictable that way. And you let the stories were leading the length of the piece.
The old ATC clock only had a few slices and a lot of open space. In there, one story might be 2 minutes, followed by another that was 20 minutes. It was open. It was kind of like a podcast.
But as Bill was saying there, not everyone appreciated that.
There was a conference 2 weeks after ATC rolled out, and the station managers just called Bill Siemering to the carpet for his fluffy, loose-sounding program. And there was something else that they really didn't like. And this is a digression here, but this is a podcast, so we get to have digressions.
And of course, I got this criticism from some about women's voices and all that stuff, that on FM, women's voices have the high frequencies, and you know, you should see the meter, Bill, when women's voices come on and that kind of thing.
Really? They said women's voices were too high for FM?
Yeah, that some voices would peak the meter too.
Oh, my God!
The upshot, Bill Siemering was out of NPR a year and a half later. And in the years that followed, the NPR clock began a long process of becoming more subdivided. The women he hired, like Linda Wertheimer and Susan Stamberg, are well known. Siemering went on to help turn Fresh Air with Terry Gross into a national program, and he's the kind of the patron saint of creative, open-style public radio, including this program right here.
But, you know, being loose and open can also be its own form of pain.
People often mention to me, you know, the boy, those were the halcyon days of all things considered, and I was there. No, they weren't.
That's Neil Conan, who's done everything at NPR, including until recently, hosting the two-hour live call-in program Talk of the Nation.
Neil Conan loves the clock. For him, it's an art form unto itself.
There's these little things that, if you've never done it, are impossible. If you've done it forever, you don't even think about doing them. You know, how long is 5 seconds? 5 seconds is a long time. You can ID 3 guests and say goodbye in 5 seconds.
So it's not surprising that when Neil Conan took over Talk of the Nation, he added more time elements, more posts.
Because it turns out you've said pretty much all you need to say about medical marijuana by the 40, and you should go on and do something else.
Unfortunately, Neil Conan is doing something else now. NPR recently canceled Talk of the Nation after 21 years, and he resigned.
Neil Conan says artificial constraints make us better. And I know this as a person who edits audio stories. We lose perspective when we're inside the story, just trying to make sense of all our reporting. We can't tell what's important anymore. If we don't have any constraints, we can make boring and confusing stuff. The constraint doesn't have to be a time limit, but at least the clock forces us to have a perspective. It says stop right there and figure out what really matters.
Of course, the clock can also limit what you say, as we'll have to do in the broadcast version of this piece. Or it can create nonsense, where you suddenly have to fill time you didn't expect to fill.
So there was a day long ago when Neil Conan was not master of the clock. When he first started at NPR in the late 70s, he had to direct this new show called Weekend All Things Considered.
I was being briefed on the clock by the then director of Weekend All Things Considered, Deborah Amos, who's gone on to some renown as a reporter. And my question to her was, you mean exactly to time? And I think we ended that first show that I produced about 4 minutes early. I was so terrified of blowing the post.
So a while ago, I went to hear Deborah Amos speak. And afterwards, I asked her if this story was true, that Neil Conan ended his first live NPR show 4 minutes early. And she said they did. And that they had to grab the longest film music they could find in the studio, which was some kind of whale song.
No super designed, subdivided format is telling us when to stop this story. We're just kind of winging it. But you know, people in radio are always kind of winging it. Whether you're in a studio shed like mine, where I don't even think I have a clock in this room at all, except for what's on the computer, or you're in the broadcast palace in D.C. with clocks everywhere.
Okay, we had to do some adjustments, but we're good. Melissa, you have the line.
We just hope someone out there is listening.
Okay, see, disaster avoided.
Yeah, she finished 45 seconds earlier.
But they're not listening hard enough to hear the clock monster that haunts the dreams of anyone who's looked into its dark soul.
Yeah, stand by. Ready. Open. Under.
All things considered continues in a moment.
Take her out. Ready. Hit break.
That piece came to us from the podcast 99% Invisible and producers Roman Mars and Julie Barton. When we return, we'll talk about some of the brave birds that don't mind hunkering down through a New Hampshire winter. From the American tree sparrow to the snowy owl, word of mouth puts a bird on it after the break.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Birds in New England are most commonly associated with spring, but as birdwatcher Eric Masterson explains, there are plenty of species that brave the winter weather and live here year-round. Eric is protection specialist with the Harris Center for Conservation Education and author of Birdwatching in New Hampshire. That's a hyper-local guide to the best birding spots and events the state has to offer. Eric, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Taylor. Thanks for having me.
So it is starting to feel a little more like winter every day. You know, temperatures are dropping. Many parts of the region have had their first dusting of snow. So before we touch on the species that do stick around, is it too late to catch any birds that have yet to migrate?
It's kind of on the tail end of it, yeah. I live in the Monadnock region, so we have winter come a little bit earlier to us. We had a little bit more than a dusting. So that clears the birds out. And so the ones that are left are ones that can survive in a, you know, freshwater birds don't do well when the water freezes. And so if they can transition to a marine environment, so any birds that can live out their life on the salt water do well. So like common loons, they head to the salt water. So you'll see them in New Hampshire off the coast, but not inland. Seed eaters, so birds that can feed on mast that has fallen to the forest floor, like grouse and turkeys, sparrows. And then scavengers, you know, the birds that do well around humans, like starlings and sparrows, they stay around. But insect eaters, birds that rely on fresh water, not so good. If you're a kingfisher trying to dive into a pond to catch fish and it's frozen, not so good for
you.
Yeah,
you're going to get a lot thinner.
Yeah.
So how come if there are so many birds that do reside in the state year-round, how come we don't hear them as much? It seems like birdsong is something associated so much with springtime, you know, that the whole air erupts with birdsong. But in the winter, I feel like I don't hear it as much. But maybe
well, you do know, you're absolutely right. So birds, so you just take a cardinal, for instance, and a cardinal has a number of different call notes that it uses, and then it has a song. And songs are just used in the summer to attract a mate and defend a territory. And if you're not doing that, you don't want to advertise your presence to predators. So they leave out the songs in the winter, pretty much. You can occasionally hear songs in the winter, but pretty much they're left out. And they just use call notes to keep in touch with each other or to sound an alarm, like a chickadee dee dee dee, the chickadee's alarm call. That the number of D's in the chickadee dee dee is a function of how high the threat level is. So they'll use those, but they won't sing because they just don't want to attract predators.
So four or five D's is like
not good.
The red alert.
Yeah, right.
So this is a very strange question. You mentioned the different things that winter birds are able to eat, seeds especially, you mentioned. We were talking back in our pod, we were talking about when we've seen birds that are eating trash. You know, this is something that sometimes I've seen in the winter times where birds seem to be basically dumpster diving. Mm-hmm. And we were wondering, now, is that a very bad thing? And what is that doing?
Well, it was, when I think of dumpsters, I think of landfills. And landfills are a disappearing feature of our landscape. There used to be a lot more. So, for instance, if you went back 20 years, there were thousands of gulls in the Keene area because Keene had a landfill. It doesn't anymore. The trash outside of landfills, clearly trash. You know, if you go to a cafe and have a scone, you'll see the little sparrows, English sparrows, down around the table picking up crumbs. It's not bad for them. I mean, if there's a a place where a lot of birds congregate, like a landfill, it can be a place where disease is transmitted more easily because there's a lot of birds in close proximity. So you do get outbreaks of things like botulism in communities where there's a lot of birds. But no, in general, no. But they're disappearing anyway. So landfills, which are the big dumpsters, they're going. There's only a few left in the state.
Okay, well, let's get back to which birds are still around in the winter. So yeah. Any rare birds specifically that we should be keeping an eye on this time of year?
Well, last winter, folks may remember, we had this incredible once-in-a-hundred-year invasion of snowy owls because mm-hmm. there was a very successful breeding season for lemmings in the Arctic, which in turn supported a very successful year for snowy owls. And so there is probably still more snowy owls. That massive peak in the population probably hasn't returned entirely to normal, and there's probably going to be an elevated number of snowies this year. Some years they're quite scarce, so I expect there'll be a good year. I've already seen one, and there's been a couple around the state.
Where did you see it?
Out on Star Island.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that was sort of the prime breeding ground before?
No, they don't breed anywhere close to here. They don't breed south of there. They breed north of the tree line, so way up in Arctic tundra, in the tundra in Canada. So nowhere closer than Quebec, northern Quebec. But they winter here in regularly, but in very fluctuating numbers, as we've seen.
And aside from the owls, do any birds migrate specifically to the region for the wintertime?
Oh, totally, yeah. So there's a sparrow. A lot of our sparrows, so even though sparrows eat seed, even seed eaters find it tough going in the winter, and they pretty much, they're still here, but their numbers are reduced. So a lot of sparrows can be scarce in the winter. But there's one species that comes in exclusively for the winter called the American tree sparrow. And it breeds, again, north of us in Canada and is quite common in the winter. And they've just started arriving in the last couple of weeks, so they're a late migrant.
I've always imagined birdwatching to be an activity that requires a great deal of patience. Sometimes a lot of sitting around, I would think,
Totally.
waiting for the moment to happen. Does the cold weather make it harder for those like yourself who are especially looking for those rare sightings?
Oh, very much so. Yeah, I am. Cold, and especially, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of the birds congregate at the coast because it's where the water remains open, and cold is even colder when you throw in wind coming in off the ocean. So it can be really bitter, yeah. So I'm waiting for the perfect car to be developed that has glass windshield that's flat so it doesn't cause spherical problems when you look through. If you look through a regular car windshield with binoculars,
everything's distorted.
So I want the perfect car that has a sunroof, a flat windshield, so you don't have to get out of your car and brave the elements.
Well, I'll let you know if I see one.
Right.
As a birder, is a large part of the thrill seeing something rare, or do you appreciate all birds, regardless of how common they may be? Like, do you still get a kick when you catch a glimpse of a wild turkey or, a city pigeon?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I liken bird watching from a cultural perspective to it's a very large tent. And in that tent, there are people who enjoy birds on so many different levels. And there are listers. There was this movie last year, I think it was last year or the year before, The Big Year, which described one particular subculture of birding. There are people who just are interested in hawk watching. I see them every year. For a couple of days up on Pachmannadnock hawk watching, and I won't see him for the rest of the year. There are other people who are just interested in gulls. So there's a lot of subcultures within this big tent. So it's really kind of fascinating. The people who the practitioners of bird watching are kind of a fascinating group of people. I myself kind of eschew rare bird chasing and listing. I'm not really interested in that.
And listing, is that when you're sort of counting the number of bird sightings? So it's almost like a sport.
To be honest, it is totally a sport. And it sometimes I think that there's less, that folks, that the listing subculture has more in common with stamp collecting or train spotting than it does with some other bird watchers who might be, take more of a scientific or a conservationist bent. Nothing wrong with it. It's not a subjective comment. It's just I guess it is a subjective comment. But
but I suppose for you, as somebody who might be interested in seeing any bird, it is about the biology and the miracle of nature.
For me, I remember the last moment I that really stopped me in my tracks. I was on a boat out in the Gulf of Maine, and a flock of 50 American golden plovers flew over. And we were about 80 miles out to sea, and I know the biology of this species. It breeds across the Arctic tundra in Canada from Alaska east to Hudson Bay. And the entire population, with a few straggle down the coast, but the majority of the population leaves the North American continent from the Maritimes and flies out over the Atlantic nonstop to South America.
Wow.
And so I saw them 80 miles out to sea. I took a bearing on the direction they were going, and I knew I saw them come into my field of view from the left, travel across maybe for 30 seconds, and they were gone. I would never see them again. And I knew that they were in the midst of this multi-day migration. And that's just, for me, that's what it's about. It's just an awe-inspiring miracle.
Well, for anybody interested in getting into bird watching this coming winter, any recommendations? You mentioned Star Island. Is that a really good place to start?
Star Island's always terrific because it's the coast is always terrific. Coast tends to be a collecting point. Birds, a lot of species of birds avoid, unless they're clearly marine species, a lot of species of birds avoid open water. And so they tend to collect at the coast. It's like a collecting point. And so you can get higher concentrations and then you can get odd species mixed in the mix. Higher concentrations of common birds and higher concentrations of rare birds. So coast is a good place. And Star Island is my favorite place on the coast. I go out there a lot. It's not great at this time of year because there are very few birds around relative to the summer. It's much better in spring and fall. But the coast is a good time. The water still hasn't frozen yet. So a lot of the open lakes, a lot of the lakes are still, I'd say most of the lakes are still open. And waterfowl will congregate, will be pushed out of the rivers into the larger lakes where they'll roost. And so you can get migrant species and local species congregating on lakes this time of year, and you can get some neat species.
Eric Masterson is Land Protection Specialist with the Harris Center for Conservation Education and author of Birdwatching in New Hampshire. Eric, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
You're welcome.
The sport of birding relies on more than just a keen sense of sight. For many enthusiasts, it's the sound of a bird that helps to identify a rare species. From the Encyclopedia of Life, Ari Daniel Shapiro brings us this story of a professor whose ears are just as valuable as his eyes.
Well, I'm going to take you out to show you a few of our nice local native birds and to listen to them particularly. We'll go across the street here, I think.
Peter Slater was professor of natural history at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland.
Professor of natural history is a lovely old Scottish title.
He retired a couple years back, but almost 10 years ago, Peter was my advisor for my master's degree. And when I was in Scotland recently, I took him up on his offer to go on a local bird walk. We started right on Peter's doorstep.
I take my dog for a walk every morning in St. Andrews, and I count all the birds that I see or hear. And I usually get up to 20 or 30 different sorts of bird. Actually, quite a few of those I hardly ever see, but because I've been studying birdsong for many years, I can actually recognize them by their voice.
Why do you keep track of the birds like that?
For fun. It's quite... there's a joy in being able to recognize the different sounds that they produce. Now we're going to get run over here, I think, so we've got to be a bit careful.
We made our way along a few streets before arriving on a wide pedestrian walkway lined with trees.
There's a chaffinch singing somewhere around here. That's him there.
What do chaffinches look like?
They're a sort of reddy orange breast and a grayish head and a sort of russet brown back. That's a male, and they have two white wing bars, and so they're quite striking. The female, is, as in many species, is much more dowdy. There he is. Isn't he lovely? I love chaffinches, my favourite bird. And his female will probably be sitting on eggs. And he's singing away in the treetops there, keeping other males out of the territory. He doesn't sit on the eggs, but he does help her feed the chicks. So when the eggs hatch, he will stop singing and he will start bombing to and fro, collecting caterpillars and insects and things and stuffing them into the beaks of the chicks. But at the moment, his main task, I think, is to keep the territory free of other chaffinches so that when the eggs hatch, that territory is theirs and theirs alone. And all the food on it that's suitable for chaffinches is there for him, for his female, and for their chicks in the nest.
And what's going on in the song here?
It consists of a trill of little notes like that. But at the end of it, wheep, did you hear at the end, there's a thing called a flourish. The trill consists of different sorts of notes. It'll sing A-A-A-A-A, B-B-B-B-B, C-C-C-C-C, and then it'll sing D, which is to make the flourish at the end. So birdsong is usually used, one, to attract females, the other, to keep rivals out. And they use the same song for both those reasons.
It seems like kind of listening for and looking out for birds in your neighborhood is something that a lot of people can do, even if they live in a rather settled area.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, an awful lot of birds live in towns and cities. Birds are attracted to human habitations and gardens. I don't know, I should think you could hear at the moment about 10 or 15 different species of birds singing in St. Andrews in this little area here. It's certainly something you can do bang in the middle of cities, no problem. And it's rather charming. Listen to that, just as we walk in the Botanic Garden, a wren. That's the same as your wren. It's a winter wren. They're small and brown and speckledy. and they have a tiny little upturned tail, and they eat insects. Wren song has about the highest rate of production of notes of any bird song. I can't remember how it is. It's 30 or 40 different notes in 1 second. I mean, they really come very, very thick and fast. Hear the wren there? Isn't that beautiful? The most extraordinary little bird, you know, an incredibly varied song it produces at a fantastic rate and produces a huge volume of sound out of this tiny, tiny little body.
What are the species, the genus and species for the chaffinch and the wren?
The chaffinch is Fringilla.
Fringilla
coelebs.
Coelebs.
Coelebs. And the wren is Troglodytes troglodytes. There it is. I mean, it is so difficult to describe sounds verbally. I think it's right, like describing wine or something like that. You know, you get these people who are extraordinarily expert at using particular phrases to describe the taste of a white wine or something. And it's like these sort of sounds. How do you describe that? What words can you use? It defies description in many ways.
You have to hear it.
You have to hear it, really.
Well, that does it for today's show. Thank you so much for spending some time with us. And if you like what you heard, there's more at wordofmouthradio.org. While you're there, you can check out photos and sounds of some of the birds that winter in New England. And who knows, maybe that'll inspire you to bust out the binoculars and get into the sport of birdwatching yourself. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.